Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is episode 93 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know as a law enforcement officer in Virginia to better strengthen, protect your communities as far as new cases, new law? And today, we're talking about patting down vehicles for weapons during traffic stops. This week, there was a really interesting ruling from the Virginia Court of Appeals regarding a traffic stop where an officer developed reasonable suspicion that the person had a firearm in the vehicle. The officer removed the person from the vehicle, patted down the driver's area, and found a firearm. The defendant was a convicted felon, and the defendant challenged the pat down of the vehicle. And the Court of Appeals affirmed and said it was a lawful search, and it was correct to admit the evidence, and therefore affirmed the defendant's conviction. But the court's reasoning and its ruling are one of the strongest statements in favor of vehicle pat-downs that we've seen in the last few years, since a case called Hill versus Commonwealth from the Virginia Supreme Court. And the court makes some interesting statements in here that I think are really worth examining, because I think it helps guide us, even though it's an unpublished case, and so it's not a case that carries, you know, ruling authority, it still gives us a really good sense, I think, about where the Court of Appeals is going on this issue. So it's also a good chance, I think, for us to kind of look at some previous rulings, not just from the Court of Appeals, but Virginia Supreme Court, Fourth Circuit, and so on, in the last 6 months. So let's dive into it, and let's see what this case is all about. Now, to start with, like I said, this is a case that was just decided this week by the Virginia Court of Appeals. And interestingly, this is a case where the opinion is written by Judge Lorish. And Judge Lorish is the same judge who gave us the opinion, the ruling that we had in episode 91, just a couple of episodes ago, on probable cause, that probable cause is not enough to have a search. You can have a search based on incident to arrest or a search based on exigent circumstances or whatever, but merely the fact that you have probable cause that somebody has drugs or contraband on them is not enough to search them. So that same judge writes the opinion in this case. And this is a case from the city of Bristol. Now, this case is a case where officers stop a vehicle for a moving violation, and the officer walks up to the passenger side of the vehicle at the beginning rather than the driver's side. When he is walking up to the vehicle, he already knows that this stop has taken place at night in a high crime area known for narcotics. And when he walks up to the vehicle, he sees the passenger has a knife sheath, and he asks the passenger about it, and the passenger says, yeah, it's got a knife in it. The officer notices that the defendant and his passenger are very nervous, and so he tells the driver and the passenger he's going to search the vehicle for weapons, and immediately when he does, the defendant starts reaching into areas of the vehicle. The officer says, hey man, stop reaching around the vehicle. At that point, the defendant starts reaching into his jacket or his waistband area. Again, the officer says, stop reaching around the vehicle, and the defendant then goes and reaches for like a shirt or a jacket from the center console and places it towards the back of the vehicle. So the third time, the officer again tells the defendant to stop reaching around the vehicle, put your hands back on the steering wheel, and this time, finally, the defendant's hands come back up, and he starts reaching, but now when his hands come back, he starts reaching into his pockets. So now this is just game over. The officer pulls him out of the vehicle, frisks him, puts him in handcuffs, and he pats him down. He doesn't find anything of note. So at that point, the officer then returns to the defendant's truck and he searches it for weapons, finding the defendant's firearm relatively quickly underneath the edge of the defendant's seat. So he moves to suppress the evidence, and the trial court denies the motion, convicts the defendant, and so the defendant ends up appealing. And so now we find ourselves back before the Court of Appeals. So the Court of Appeals repeats two things that are important from the U.S. Supreme Court. The first is the actual Terry ruling, which is from 1968, which says that a law enforcement officer can briefly stop an individual for investigative purposes if they reasonably suspect that the person, they suspect that criminal activity may be afoot. But then in addition to that, the officer has the authority to conduct a limited pat-down, what we call a frisk, of individuals that they reasonably suspect to be armed and dangerous. But then the court goes on to examine Michigan versus Long, which is the 1983 case from the U.S. Supreme Court that holds that if during a lawful traffic stop, i.e. an investigative detention for a traffic offense, an officer develops reasonable suspicion that an individual is dangerous and may gain immediate control of weapons, the officers can search the passenger compartment of an automobile, limited to those areas in which the weapon may be placed or hidden. So we're still talking about, you know, what we call a pat down or a frisk, but when you're patting down or frisking a vehicle, it basically looks like a search. It's, for all intents and purposes, a search. The difference between a search with probable cause and a search with mere reasonable suspicion for weapons is that the mission of the Michigan versus Long sort of pat down of a vehicle is limited to only for weapons. So you could probably open the console of the vehicle, but if in the console of the vehicle there was a, you know, a soft bag that didn't have any weight to it, that had some, you know, stuff in it, you don't know what it is, you don't get to open that if you can't articulate that that might have a weapon in it. And so the court here takes us back, the Court of Appeals here says, well, let's go back and let's look at the Virginia Supreme Court case of Hill versus Commonwealth, which was a case from 2019. And that case is very instructive. And so let's do that. Let's go back and look at Hill versus Commonwealth, which is a case that we haven't talked about much here before because it's happened before this podcast started, but it's a really interesting and significant case from the Virginia Supreme Court. This was a case where the defendant was had drugs in his car, not a gun. But officers find him in Portsmouth in an area they were patrolling as a high-crime, high-drug area. And these officers worked in a special investigations unit that was specializing in narcotics transactions. Between the two of them, the detectives had over 28 years of experience, seven of which was doing narcotics cases. And in that high-crime, drug area, one of the detectives had made several arrests, mostly right behind where they find Mr. Hill. So in this secluded high crime, high drug area, the detectives see Mr. Hill sitting alone in the driver's seat of a parked car. And he's leaning back in the seat, sort of watching and not really moving around. So the detectives who are in a vehicle make a U-turn, they drive back and they watch him for, as they describe it, a minute or so. And as the detectives pull up near the vehicle, Hill then begins looking up and down, and he's constantly doing a bunch of movement inside the vehicle. So at that point, the detectives pull right up alongside Mr. Hill's vehicle and park approximately 25 feet away. They don't have lights, they don't have sirens on. They're wearing their police vests and badges. They get out of the vehicle and they walk up to Hill's vehicle on the driver's side. Now, when they walk up, he takes his left hand, he puts it under the steering wheel, and then he turns his back and his head away from the officers and starts beginning digging with his right hand between the driver's seat. So when the detectives walk up to him, he looks up towards them and then immediately looks back towards the back of the car. He hunches over behind the driver's seat and goes right into the back seat with his right hand. And so at this point, the officers express a fear that he might be reaching for a weapon and shout, "Show us your hands, show us your hands, let me see your hands, let me see your hands," identify themselves as police officers, and order him at least 7 to 10 times, "Show me your hands, show me your hands." They're both visibly concerned for their safety at this point. So they're screaming to him, "Show me your hands," and he's continuing to dig around inside the vehicle. He turns his back to the detectives, he puts his head down in the vehicle as he's digging down, as he's reaching, and at this point, one of the detectives opens the door, grabs him by his forearm, and tries to pull him away, but he'll resist. He continues to pull away, dig down between the seats. At this point, the officers become very convinced that he's grabbed him trying to get a gun based on the way he's acting and reaching. So they grab him, get him out of the car, put him in handcuffs, and they say, I think he's reaching for a gun. So they go back to the vehicle to see if they can find the gun. What they end up finding instead is a bag of cocaine. And so he's convicted of possession with intent to distribute. He moves to suppress, and the trial court denies the motion to suppress, so Mr. Hill appeals. So notice at this point how similar the Johnson case that we did, that we're starting this conversation about, and the Hill case from 2019, how similar they are, right? So the case from this week, Johnson and Hill, are very similar. You have people defying commands, reaching around inside vehicles. One of the things about Hill that's interesting, though, is, you know, Johnson starts with a lawful traffic stop. It's for a traffic violation. But what was the crime that Hill committed? right? Hill is just sitting in his car. He's just sitting in his car, and the officers walk up to him, and then he starts digging around inside the car, and so he doesn't appear to be doing anything that's a criminal offense at this point. And so one of the things that Hill argues, understandably, is, hey, he's not committing an offense, so how is it that he's getting stopped in this case by these officers, right? And the issue here is, from the court's perspective, well, okay, but in this case, did the officers have a reasonable suspicion to believe that they were about to be assaulted with a weapon? In other words, they have reasonable suspicion to believe if Hill's grabbing a gun, that he's creating a reasonable fear of that they're of being assaulted, that he's going to be grabbing a gun, maybe brandishing a gun, shooting them. Did the officers in this case have reasonable suspicion that Hill is reaching for a weapon? So notice this case is different than, for example, the case from Richmond we talked about a while ago, where a guy's just walking down the street and officers see that he may have a weapon, concealed weapon on his person, so they stop him and they pat him down. And the court says, well, you can't just stop somebody because you believe they have a weapon. They haven't committed any crime. You don't have a reasonable suspicion that they're carrying the weapon concealed in violation of 18.2308 because you can lawfully carry a firearm with a permit in Virginia. So the mere fact that somebody may have a weapon is not enough to pat them down. You have to have lawfully stopped them for some kind of crime. But here, the court says, well, at the investigative detention stage, at the reasonable suspicion stage, we're talking about a standard of may have been or could have been. Whether detectives in this case reasonably suspected that Hill may have been reaching for a weapon, that he could have been trying to shoot the officers or could have been trying to grab the weapon to brandish it at them. Terry, the court emphasizes, doesn't require detectives be confident that Hill, in fact, was reaching for a weapon with the probable intent to use it, because that would be probable cause, right? And reasonable suspicion is much less than probable cause. So here, in this case, the court looks at it and says, well, the officers reasonably feared that Hill was reaching for a weapon, and so they had to make a split-second decision. And the court here writes, doing nothing risks the possibility of being shot at point-blank range. Walking away risks the possibility of being shot in the back. And so the detectives did what any experienced officer would do in this situation. They physically seized the man and separated him from the potential weapon. And the court here writes, the legitimate and weighty risks cannot be ignored given the inordinate risk confronting an officer as he approaches a person seated in an automobile. And in doing so, quotes Pennsylvania versus Mims, which is a 1977 case. And in Mims, the court had talked about a study noting that 30% of police shootings occurred when an officer approached a suspect seated in a motor vehicle. So it's interesting. The court here spends a lot of time going around and looking at cases from other jurisdictions. They look at, for example, United States versus Johnson, which is a case from the D.C. Circuit from 2000. Where officers park a vehicle about 25 feet away from Mr. Johnson, and they walk up to a vehicle. It's a vehicle just in a high crime area. Three people inside the car. They see somebody hand an object to Johnson, but that's all they see. They just see hand an object to Johnson. As they walk up, though, Johnson makes a shoving down motion, leading the officers to believe that Johnson might be armed. The officer draws his gun and says, let me see your hands. Johnson doesn't comply, but makes more and more shoving motions, finally raises his hands. Officers get to the vehicle. They pat him down, and they find, ultimately, crack, not a gun. One thing that's really interesting about Johnson and the Hill case is the courts look at the officer's decision, the officer's action of grabbing somebody and pulling them out of the vehicle, not from the point where the officers first draw their guns and say, show me your hands, but from the point where the officers actually get compliance from the defendants, when they actually get their hands on them and pull them out of the car. Because notice that in all of these cases, in Johnson, which is our case from this week, or Hill, or whatever, the defendants aren't complying. They're continuing to reach around inside the vehicle. And so we don't really get to the question of, hey, at the moment the officer gives the first command, show me your hands, stop reaching. At that point, was there reasonable suspicion to pat down the car? The courts in all these cases say, doesn't matter. We're not involved. We're not asking that question. We're not examining that question because there is no search at that point. The search only happens after the officer gives the command and the defendant doesn't comply. show me your hands, show me your hands. And it continues to reach around the vehicle. Show me your hands, show me your hands, and ignores the officer, opens the door of the car and goes to grab and he's resisting. Only when we have compliance do we look at the totality of the circumstances. And the courts here are very concerned that in all these cases, the defendants are not following the commands and continuing to reach, which to them increases the likelihood that this person has a weapon and is trying to assault the officer. In United States versus Waterman, which is another case that Hill talks about, this is a Third Circuit case from 2009. It's not a traffic stop, but officers walk up to a house. There's five people standing on a porch, and they order everybody to put their hands in the air, and everybody complies except for Waterman. So right off the bat here, notice, you know, was it lawful to walk up and tell everybody to put their hands in the air? Well, Waterman doesn't ask that question because Mr. Waterman doesn't follow the command. He keeps his hands in his pockets. They don't see a weapon in his hands, but they think he might be of an arm because he'd moved his hands towards his waistband. They keep telling him, put his hands in the air, put his hands in the air. He doesn't comply, and he moves one of his hands behind his back and goes to turn the doorknob on the front door. It doesn't open. They keep saying, put in your hands, tell me, show me your hands, show me your hands. Now somebody opens the door and lets Waterman inside the house. So the officer puts his foot inside the door to keep it from shutting. And ultimately, as a result of all this, they find guns and drugs and whatever. And the courts say, well, Waterman never submits to the command to show me your hands. So there's no seizure on the porch. The seizure happens because the officers develop reasonable suspicion to believe that he has a weapon. It's interesting, in Waterman, the court says, if the police had actually seized Waterman at that point, that is, if he had put up his hands and the officers had patted him down, that would have been unlawful. But because Waterman doesn't comply, they end up finding evidence lawfully. In United versus Mosley, again, 10th Circuit case, they look at the same kind of thing. So the court looks at cases from, you know, 10th Circuit, the court cases from the 8th Circuit, cases from the 6th Circuit, our own circuit, the 4th Circuit, the Seventh Circuit. They talk about all these cases, federal cases, and they make clear, and I want to be really clear about this with y'all too, the court is, and they write this in the opinion, we are not suggesting that the detectives would have been justified in seizing Mr. Hill if he'd simply sat in his car and just refused to show his hands when the officers commanded him to do so. Right? So in other words, this is not a case about officers just walking up and saying to anybody they want, show me your hands, show me your hands, and they have to comply, right? That's not what this case is. Hill's response is not simply refusing to comply and just not raising his hands and just staring at the officers. Hill's response in this case, his physical response, was to turn his back to the detectives, start digging around with his right hand in an area that's not visible to them, and in an area that gave the officers reasonable suspicion based on their extensive training experience that he might be grabbing a weapon. And so it's not just that he may have had a weapon, right? Anybody we stop, this is Virginia, anybody you stop might have a weapon. But in this case, it's that he's quite possibly in the very act of reaching for a weapon at the very moment the detectives were plainly expressing their concern that he might do so, right? Show me your hands, show me your hands, show me your hands. So we have a good ruling here. Now, one of the questions that comes up, and this was an issue that happens in the Johnson case, is, you'll have office people say, well, okay, but if I get the driver out of the car, the first thing I'm going to do, like the officer did here in Johnson, was get him out of the car and put him in handcuffs. Well, once he's in handcuffs, he doesn't have access to that driver's seat anymore. So how do I get to pat down that driver's seat area for a weapon? And this was an issue that, in fact, had come up in Michigan versus Long itself. In Michigan versus Long itself, the court had, in fact, rejected the argument from the Michigan Supreme Court in that case that you can't pat down a vehicle once you've taken a driver and put him in handcuffs and put him in the backseat of your car because that driver no longer has access to the passenger compartment of that car. So in Michigan versus Long, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote, the search of the passenger compartment of an automobile, limited to those areas in which a weapon may be placed or hidden, is permissible if the officer possesses a reasonable belief based on specific and articulable facts which, taken together with the rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrant the officer in believing the suspect is dangerous and may gain immediate control of weapons. And regarding this argument from the Michigan Supreme Court, the court says suspects may injure police officers and others by virtue of their access to weapons, even though they may themselves not be armed. The court here says the Michigan Supreme Court appeared to believe that it was not reasonable for the officers to fear that Long could injure them because he was effectively under their control during the investigative stop and could not get access to any weapons that might have been located in the vehicle. But the court says this reasoning is mistaken in several respects. Right? A Terry suspect in Long's position could break away from police control and retrieve a weapon from his automobile. If the suspect is not placed under arrest, he will be permitted to re-enter his automobile, and he will then have access to any weapons inside. Or the suspect may be permitted to re-enter the vehicle before the Terry investigation is over, and again, may have access to weapons. And in the Johnson case from last week, Judge Lorisch repeats this again and says, in a footnote, and says, again, the scope of the search is proper. The court quotes Michigan versus Long and notes here again, if he's not arrested, he's going to be allowed to re-enter the vehicle after he's taken out of handcuffs. And so because he's not under arrest at the time of the search, the officer is properly patting down the vehicle by searching inside, looking for the firearm or weapon that he might be trying to get access to while the defendant is in handcuffs in the backseat of the police car. And if you want to, you can go back, and we talk about this issue a lot in episode 66, which is the case on U.S. versus Buster, and then it's a follow-up, episode 75, which we talk about U.S. versus Gist Davis, which are two cases that sort of construe this not in a traffic stop context, but in the subject stop context. They're both interesting cases, and this is sort of a rabbit hole we could dive down for a long time. But, you know, the basic idea here is that during the course of a traffic stop, the fact that somebody may be armed and may get immediate control of weapons can create a danger to you, right? The U.S. Supreme Court dealt with this in a case called Adams versus Williams all the way back in 1972. And that was a traffic stop where an officer had information from an informant who was sufficiently reliable to give him reasonable suspicion that the driver of the vehicle was carrying a firearm. And this is, again, an officer in a high crime area of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he walks up to the vehicle. The vehicle is stopped in the road. It's not driving. And he taps on the window. The driver rolls the window down. And at that point, the officer has reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is armed. He reaches inside and grabs the vehicle, the weapon away from the defendant, which it was concealed, I think, on his waistband. And he pulls the gun out. And the defendant moves to suppress. But here, the court, you know, this is only a few years after the Terry case. We're still figuring out what the limits are on Terry. And the U.S. Supreme Court in this case writes that the court recognized in Terry that the policeman making a reasonable investigatory stop should not be denied the opportunity to protect himself from attack by a hostile suspect. And quotes Terry, when an officer is justified in believing that the individual whose suspicious behavior he's investigating at close range is armed and presently dangerous to the officer or others, he may conduct a limited protective search for concealed weapons. And again, we use this word pat down like it's some kind of magical thing. But, you know, Terry talks about this being a search, this idea that, oh, we can just use our hands and just pat the person. That's not really what Terry says, right? It's a search in the sense that it's a search only for weapons, and you can look and you can search anywhere that a person reasonably might have weapons, but you have to limit what you're doing to examine only for weapons. The purpose of this limited search is not to discover evidence of a crime, but to allow the officer to pursue his investigation without fear of violence, and thus the frisk for weapons might be equally necessary and reasonable. And it's interesting here in Adams, the court says, the frisk for weapons might be equally necessary and reasonable whether or not carrying a concealed weapon violated any state law. Now, we've had a debate, you know, for a long time, what would the Virginia Court of Appeals think about just removing a firearm or frisking someone who's a driver in a traffic stop for, you know, speeding or running a red light at 3 p.m, not in a high crime area, who's got a concealed carry permit and the driver has a firearm on their person, or be reasonable suspicion that the driver has a firearm. Could we pat that person down simply on the fact that we're stopping him for a crime and he's potential reasonable suspicion that he's got a gun? Well, you know, here the court in Adams, which is the 1972 case from the U.S. Supreme Court, says so long as the officer is entitled to make a forcible stop and has reason to believe the suspect is armed and dangerous, he may conduct a weapon search limited in scope to this protective purpose. It doesn't matter whether it's lawful or unlawful to carry the gun. The question is he dangerous to you? And this question of dangerous, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about. What would make somebody potentially dangerous to you? There's lots of different things that can make somebody potentially dangerous. But I think this week's case, Johnson, and the Hill case, the Virginia Supreme Court case that it relies on from 2019, both give us, you know, really good examples of what can make a person dangerous. And that is somebody reaching around inside the vehicle in defiance of clear commands not to do so. Show me your hands, keep your hands where they're supposed to be. Instead, the person, in defiance of those commands, continues to reach around the vehicle, reaching into areas where there may be weapons, in repeated defiance of those commands. We have both of those in both these cases. And in Hill, Hill wasn't committing any crime at all. So, you know, query whether or not if all that had happened in Hill was they'd walked up and just, you know, pointed guns at him and said, show me your hands, and he didn't do anything. Well, the Virginia Supreme Court is clear that they don't think that would be a lawful stop. But him starting to reach and look away from the officers and reaching deep inside the vehicle is important. And again, notice that these are both stops in high crime areas known for narcotics, and both stops by officers who were able to articulate that they in their training experience, you know, reasonably believed and feared that he had a weapon. By the way, you know, one thing to watch out for is this is the courts are serious about these really being limited in scope for weapons. There was a case called Commonwealth versus Hendrick, which is a case from the Virginia Court of Appeals from December. And this is a case where they come up on a vehicle stopped in a high crime area for a traffic violation. The defendant is hunched over. He's leaned towards the steering wheel, looking back in the mirror. They believe, again, he's engaged in furtive movements. So they pull him out of the vehicle. They pat him down. They don't find any weapons. And he tells the officers he's just been released from jail on the offense of possession of a firearm by a felon. So they know he's a felon and he's had a gun before. So the officers pat down the vehicle and they find drugs in the car. And the trial court suppresses the evidence. And the Court of Appeals agrees and believes, yes, it should have been patted down. Now, by the way, they had gotten a dispatch that said the defendant was probably armed, so watch out for him. So, and that was in the middle of patting the vehicle down, they get this dispatch. So you might say, well, hang on a second here. Doesn't that defy everything you just told me? But no, it doesn't, and here's why. Here, that it happens late at night in a high crime area, and yeah, we've got some furtive movements. But what happens here in this case? The officers are looking around inside the vehicle, and an officer, when he finds drugs in the vehicle, says, oh, there you go. That's all the drugs right there. The court says, yes, officers can conduct a protective sweep, but they have to limit the sweep to a search for weapons that a person might gain immediate control over. In this case, this search is caught on body camera. And in this case, the court says, if you watch it, this is a search for drugs, not weapons. The officers are clearly looking only for drugs. Their statements indicate they're only looking for drugs. When they find the drugs, he says, oh, there you go, that's his drugs. They stop looking around inside the vehicle, and they don't look for any more weapons. They don't look for weapons at all anymore. Once they find the drugs, they're done. So the court here says, even assuming you had reasonable articulable suspicion predictive sweep, the officers exceeded the permissible scope of that by going to look for drugs inside the vehicle instead of weapons. So again, a pat down in a vehicle, it must be restricted to a search, such as it is, but for weapons and weapons only. And you can get yourself in trouble sort of trying to do anything else. So a few interesting, you know, cases I think worth talking about here. The Johnson case, again, we talked about this issue last week about cases being published and unpublished. Johnson is an unpublished case, so it is not controlling authority in Virginia. But the Hill case absolutely is controlling authority in Virginia. That's a Virginia Supreme Court case from 2019. But nevertheless, I think the Johnson case is an important ruling. It's Judge Lorish, like I said, who is, you know, somebody who's not afraid of suppressing evidence if the judge sees perceived violation of the Fourth Amendment. But here, a strong statement in favor of Michigan versus Long, and a long line of cases before that, no pun intended, which I think is good for you as law enforcement. So I hope today was interesting. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. We're on SoundCloud, Stitcher Podcasts. You know, we're on a bunch of different apps and so on. And I am going to try to get on Spotify if I can. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. Other than that, that's all for today. That's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.